Democrats. His name is Lee Fong, and he wrote a very lengthy, very well-researched piece, which we're going to be talking about today. So the name of the piece is called How Online Learning Companies Bought America's Schools, and it's in, I think, the current issue of The Nation. It's online. You can read the whole thing online, and it's also up on our Facebook wall at Momocrats if you want to look at it there. But anyway, so Lee, this has really seemed welcome. This has really seemed like a turning point, in my opinion. I've been tracking a lot of this kind of writing about education, and it really just seems that within the last couple of years, and specifically within this past year, that both efforts to privatize education have been intensified, and at the same time, people who are sort of fighting the good fight as yourself and trying to keep public education truly public and democratic have also sort of stepped up investigation into the big money interests that are trying to drive this. Do you want to maybe pick out a few highlights of the article for us?
Well, sure. Cynthia, thank you so much for having me on. I haven't written much about education in the past. This is somewhat of a new topic for me. It came up in an interesting way because I saw what was going on in Wisconsin. I reported on that a great deal with collective bargaining and what happened in Ohio and some of these other states, and I was monitoring it very closely. At the same time, I came across some of the documents and the audio clips that I cited in my piece, and it just kind of clicked for me because I thought this is an interesting story that people need to know about because, as you know perfectly well, there's a perfect storm that a lot of these profiteers, I think you could call them, have been exploiting. You know, there's been a continuous campaign over the past two decades to really crack K-12 education and make it into a cash cow for Wall Street, and usually that's failed. At the same time, there are many partisan elements in the Republican Party that would like to see Democrats suffer in the future, and they see kind of destroying the public sector unions as the best way to get there. And finally, there's this kind of phenomenon that we've seen since the Obama era where the right has reorganized and built this monolith of a large political infrastructure in the states. You know, all these little new think tanks and groups like ALEC have expanded rapidly. And it's all come together. And, you know, we can talk a little bit later about the policy, but on the political side, it just has allowed them to push farther than they ever have before. You know, when these types of laws have been put to the ballot in terms of state ballot initiatives, you know, allowing vouchers or, you know, any of these types of things, it's always failed. It's almost remarkable how much it's failed, and it's been rejected by the voters. But they've pretty much come up with a formula that they're passing these laws now in rapid succession, even though they never campaigned last year promising these big, very fundamental policy changes. They're getting them implemented from really coast to coast.
Well, I just want to kind of go over a few points that you hit just even on your first page. And I think it's no accident that you use the term a perfect storm, because I think that in some ways, while 99% of the country, shall we say, was in deep mourning over Hurricane Katrina and the just disaster that that was for the country and for the city of New Orleans, and especially in terms of, you know, what seems like the social contract in terms of our responsibilities to one another to help and reach out, especially in times of disaster, the 1% of the country was saying things like, well, that seemed to work out pretty well for them. And, you know, New Orleans school system really needed a Hurricane Katrina, I believe a congressman said that. So, you know, I was really struck by, in your article, kind of deeper in, there's a, I think, a venture capitalist who cited, or a lobbyist who cited, as saying, you know, leave no, don't waste a good disaster, basically. And that mm-hmm. reminds me of Naomi Klein's shock doctrine, which, interestingly enough, like 5 pages into her book, talking about disaster capitalism, mentions, you know, Hurricane Katrina's impact on the New Orleans public school system. So I think there's been just a kind of acceleration of ways that big moneyed interests have kind of learned from that and are really kind of stepping up their efforts. So you start the piece by kind of locating us in Florida, and Florida seems like a real hotbed for a lot of these kinds of innovations. And you mentioned that even as recently as 2010, that kind of resistance that legislators had to passing these things, you know, through the regular sort of process, you know, met with a lot of resistance. And can you mm-hmm. tell us a little more about sort of the techniques used to really kind of, you know, crack open that nut, as you were saying?
Well, Florida is interesting. It's the birthplace of a lot of these ideas. When Governor Jeb Bush was in office in the late 90s, he kind of set some of these things into position. That he enacted some of the first virtual charter schools, the nonprofit, the Florida Virtual School Program, some of the voucher programs. Some of them were of course later struck down by the courts. But as time progressed, the people weren't demanding these policies, and the new governor, Charlie Crist, the Republican turned independent, and most of the legislature wasn't terribly excited about these policies. Charlie Crist even sided with the teachers' unions on a big teacher tenure vote. The Republican legislature even offered a budget at one point, cutting the budget of virtual schools. Jeb Bush's kind of baby there. So part of the beginning of the piece takes place at I believe a Ritz-Carlton in Florida, and it's in a room filled with education reform, as they call themselves, strategists and philanthropists, and they're sitting around talking about all of these failures just, you know, a year or two ago in states like Florida, and they're strategizing on how to lift up the movement and plow forward. And they're talking, I mean, I didn't have space to put in all of this into the piece, but they're talking about how, you know, Waiting for Superman and some of these other things that we've seen on television and in the entertainment world has lifted their cause. They're starting to win back public opinion, but they'd like to really put their agenda back in the top line and push things very aggressively. And this one lobbyist, who's also a philanthropist, Patricia Leves, talks with Rick Berman, the infamous anti-union, the union-busting strategist, and they're plotting all these different strategies to basically trick the unions, to trick the public, and get some of their charter laws passed, in their words, quote, under the radar, because they would sponsor a litany of bills that would upset the public sector unions, everything from paycheck protection to kind of almost punitive disclosure, where they would kind of just go after the Florida teachers unions. Even they would push an effort to allow taxpayer money to go to religious schools. And they explicitly said during the strategy session with these other education philanthropies, like the Dell Foundation, the Michael and Susan Dell Foundation, that they were disingenuous. They didn't want these things to pass. Their strategy was to spread the unions and some of the their opposition thin, to confuse them and to basically keep them on different fronts so they could push their agenda or what they really want passed with little opposition.
Interesting, huh? So sort of divide and conquer, confuse
exactly.
and distract kind of method. So maybe, you know, maybe the collective bargaining or the, you know, hitting it at pensions is really just getting us to shadow box, and then they kind of go in for the kill, which is really to open up states and create markets, basically, for this kind of online learning.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think it's really interesting, too, that Patricia Levesque, I don't know if you just mentioned this, I'm sorry if I'm repeating, but I just think it was so notable that, number one, you mentioned that she was both a lobbyist and a philanthropist in the article, and then you also make sure to, you know, illuminate the connection she has to Jeb Bush. She was an advisor to him, and I think is now also advising Scott. Is that right?
That's right. And this is actually kind of a secondary theme to the article, because it's an interesting phenomenon that I think you actually see replicated in other issue areas. You see this in, at least I reported this in the oil industry. You know, you have a lot of folks who are quote-unquote energy policy experts, or folks who wanted to go and talk about climate change from an academic point of view. But they were not only funded in many cases by oil and coal, but they literally worked at lobbying firms with an interest in, you know, pushing the oil and coal agenda. Well, here in education, there's a very similar dynamic, but it's not being called out as much as it is in the energy space. So many of the education reform advocates, the people who are working for literal charities and foundations that are pushing education reform policies, many of them are actually just lobbyists to the for-profit companies, many of them education technology companies, that are hoping to benefit from the same policies they're pushing through their philanthropies. Patricia is a great example, because while she is the head of Jeb Bush's National Education Reform Nonprofit, as well as his Florida affiliate, she has her own lobbying firm, and her partner is also at that firm involved in education reform. I believe her husband is the general counsel for the Florida House. So she's got her fingers in a lot of these things. And at the same time as she's telling everyone that we need unlimited funding for virtual schools, we need unlimited access for parents to enroll their students in virtual schools, that sort of thing, she has virtual schools paying her paycheck. And she's not disclosing that at any of these events. And she's not the only one. I mean, there are many different examples. The people who are involved in some of these other education reform nonprofits, it's the same dynamic.
I'm also really kind of interested to explore further, and I think we'll end up talking about this more, is how it is that there's sort of this unholy alliance that's formed between sort of the high-tech world and a lot of Silicon Valley kinds of libertarian or neoliberal or even some, you know, Democratic-leaning Silicon Valley wealthy folks who are sort of behind a lot of these philanthropies and foundations, and a partnership they've struck up with some really sort of hoary old players on the hard right and conservatives who have been, you know, trying for years to get vouchers to get passed and things like that, you know, embrace charter schools with open arms, you know, that kind of thing. And I thought that was also a very interesting thing that came out in your article, is that sort of alliance that's formed. Can you talk more about that?
There are a good number of prominent Democrats involved in this movement, and, you know, you can't really question the motivations of some of them, because maybe this is just their own worldview, and for whatever reason they don't like public education, and they particularly don't like any traditional form of it. But there are a good number of them in Silicon Valley and San Francisco that are guiding this movement, that are saying they're doing this because they just are so upset at abysmal graduation rates and test scores, that sort of thing, that they've had enough, and that they're going to be funneling, you know, tens, hundreds, sometimes millions of dollars, hundreds of thousands, sometimes millions of dollars into these really vicious right-wing attack groups. And you think, well, you know, this isn't typical for a Democrat, but maybe this is just one of their kind of idiosyncratic issue areas. But again, there's a good number who excuse me, are benefiting from these types of policies. You know, one person, Bill Oberndorf, is a wealthy investor. He gives to the kind of Tea Party aligned American Federation for Children Alliance for School Choice, that's run by Betsy DeVos, very far right person. But it turns out that he owned a lot of stock in the company Cambium Learning, which is one of the big online learning companies. They own Voyager Learning. And just a few months ago, Cambium basically bought back his stock for about $5 million. So he obviously has a stake in this. But Pisces, it's another education company in San Francisco. The family of Don and John Fisher are involved. Big Democrats, as I understand it. But, you know, they're contributing and getting involved in the Jeb Bush efforts because maybe there's a for-profit motive there. These questions really haven't been raised, I think, in an appropriate degree as people are talking about these policies.
You know, Lee, this is Carol Lee. I just came across yesterday, I didn't realize this, but in Michigan, just to kind of put an exclamation point on what you just said, one of the laws they passed earlier this year allows for unlimited school funding or public funding for online schools. So, I mean, I consider that a disaster, and that basically passed completely under the radar. It's amazing. And the reason I bring it up is because yesterday I found emails that have been published by the Michigan Education Association between the Mackinac Center, if that's, I don't think I pronounced mm-hmm. that right, but you know the one I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And legislators, especially the chairman of the State Education Committee in the House for Michigan, where the McHugh, this guy McHugh from the center, basically said, you know, our goal is to make sure there's no more Michigan Education Association. In other words, you know, just get rid of the unions altogether.
That's an interesting scoop. I'd love to see those emails. Have you put them up on Crooks and Liars?
Yeah, it's up on Crooks and Liars now on the front page.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Not
a good thing for policy, but I think, you know, having that the type of primary source document is crucial, and I think you're already so good at finding those things, so that's great.
Yeah, so hopefully, you know, it'll get some attention on what's going on with these centers. I mean, I really have a problem with a center that specifically says it doesn't lobby, you know, and files that on their 990. Advising and stating goals, their goals, right? The center's goals.
I mean, that's how it's all done these days. You know, folks, you know, avoid the moniker lobbyist. You know, they do anything they can to avoid. You look at Newt Gingrich. He's been lobbying as hard as any K Street firm for the past decade, but he refuses to register and call himself a lobbyist. But, you know, it's done through all these nonprofits. The Jeb Bush Foundations are a great example because they openly state that they're funded by for-profit companies that are looking to get into the online education space, like Microsoft, like K-12 Inc., like Connections Academy and Pearson's. All these companies fund him, but he's organized as a nonprofit, so he can go around the country touting, you know, policies that directly benefit his benefactors, but not be considered a lobbyist somehow. It's quite confusing. While at the same time, the person managing his nonprofit is literally a lobbyist who's paid by these foundations. And the larger question of how they get this done in each state, they use the state policy network of, I'm going to mispronounce it as well, the Mackinac or whatever foundation in Michigan, or the Free State Foundation in Maryland, or the Pacific Research Institute in California, the McIver Institute in Wisconsin, the Buckeye Institute in Ohio. I mean, these things are centrally organized, and you know, as I've discussed in the piece, the for-profit school lobbyists actually made a big pitch back in 2010, right before the election, to make virtual schools a big priority this year. And as you can see, those lobbyists had a great effect. I don't know if money was exchanged, but I think it's likely. And they came in, and they had all these mini think tanks producing policy papers urging states to adopt these policies, while another nonprofit, the American Legislative Exchange Council, which writes bills literally for a lot of these lawmakers, they had their virtual school reform bill, again, literally written by a virtual school lobbyist, a woman named Mickey Ravenel from one of the largest virtual school operators, a for-profit company called Connections Academy based in Baltimore. So, you know, I think you're hitting the nail right on the head by talking about this is a concerted effort among nonprofits, very right-wing legislators and for-profit companies that are, again, have this agenda of not only helping these companies but diminishing teachers' unions.
I just wanted to really highlight the asymmetry that I think is going on there, because I think when you look at lefty liberal nonprofits, you know, the mission is obviously one of social change, social justice, social good, and there's a lot of emphasis on education. Certainly, you know, a lot of philanthropies, you know, fund, you know, direct services and things like that. But there's always this kind of unwillingness to be partisan. You know, I think that there's a way that maybe on the left, you know, 501c3s really kind of take seriously the nonpartisan aspects of being a 501c3 much more seriously than ALEC. And, I mean, I was shocked to discover that ALEC is a 501c3. I mean, they're pumping out this legislation, as you say. It's like a template, you know, that they just blast out around the country and find, you know, sort of, you know, stooges in state legislatures to sponsor this thing, you know, completely unchanged, as you point out in the article, in one instance, and at least one instance. And so, you know, I mean, I think of the attacks on NPR and how, you know, Jay Rosen, a professor of media and journalism, wrote a famous article called, you know, right wingers are attacking NPR, and what do? They bring a tote bag to a knife fight, you know. So I'm feeling a little bit like the asymmetry is getting repeated and kind of increasing this kind of inequality in terms of how effective we are in fighting back. You know, I'm not seeing that nonprofits should necessarily pull back from direct services. That's not what I'm saying. But I think that there is kind of a delicacy that a lot of foundations seem to have in terms of framing the issue in this way or fighting back even. And I think in addition to that, Dell and Gates provide a lot of cover for otherwise liberal foundations to kind of jump on the free market bandwagon in ways, in education, in ways that they might not in other realms, you know?
Mm-hmm.
This is just sort of an informal survey of mine. You know, I haven't written up anything or seen anything written up, but I'm certainly kind of coming to that conclusion, having looked around, and certainly noting, you know, how vociferously active the 501c3s on the right are.
Well, there's this, I think, a fundamental question here. I mean, do a lot of these philanthropies benefit the public interest? And I understand that's a very subjective term sometimes, but I think when you parse it, it's clear that a lot of these big foundations don't serve the public interest. They simply serve their corporate benefactors, which have their own very selfish interests. And this question just simply is not asked by most of the media. They see a group with a nice website and with glossy policy proposals, you know, mailed to them, and some of these big-name politicians kind of getting involved, and it kind of shuts off. They say, okay, well, these guys are legit, and we'll just quote them and unquestionably promote their materials without looking at who's backing them and who their policies really benefit. I mean, these kind of fundamental questions just simply aren't being asked, and if they were being asked, I think you'd see different policy outcomes in states like Ohio and Wisconsin, and the Michigan example is a good one, because I don't see an outcry from the public demanding that public money be sucked away from schools and given to a technology company based halfway across the country that has an abysmal education quality record. I don't see people getting out in the streets or writing letters to the editor or really showing any indication that this is what they want, but this is what they're getting. And I think I think the media has a duty to ask why we're having these outcomes and who really is pushing this agenda.
Okay, you know, we're going to open this up to calls. If you're listening and want to call in and ask a question, the number is 347-945-6465. And I'll repeat that one more time, 347-945-6465. And so we've got Donna waiting to pick up if you want to call in. You know, Lee, while we're waiting for callers, the thing also that I think doesn't get driven home is that when these organizations are doing this as nonprofits, people don't realize that the donations to those nonprofits are tax deductible, and then the income from their investments are also tax deductible, you know, for the money that they're not spending at that particular time. So essentially, these organizations exist against the public interest, but they're funded in part by the public. And that I have a real problem with. I mean, I have a real big problem with that.
There's kind of a larger dynamic of this where these for-profit school management and virtual school companies realize that really half of their business model is setting up kind of questionable nonprofits, because their most charter school laws, even if you want to qualify a virtual school, you have to first have a school district approve a charter, which is usually organized ostensibly as a nonprofit, you know, with its own quote-unquote independent board members. But then that nonprofit then can funnel all of that taxpayer money to a charter school management company of its choice. And in many cases, the virtual school lobbyists are very aggressive in coming into local communities, setting up these nonprofits, and then making sure those management fees go to a virtual school company or a preferred charter school company like Charter Schools USA. There are many of them that are for-profit, white hat management, this sort of thing. So, you know, they've not only got to kind of manage this kind of smokescreen of political nonprofits that you see out there in the media that are out there kind of pressuring lawmakers, but they also have to manage these local school district level nonprofits that are actually funneling them the big bucks of, you know, some of these schools will, you know, pay about $6,000 or so per pupil. So they're generating tens of millions in each of these situations where they control, they essentially control the actual school, even though it's ostensibly a nonprofit.
I'd like to add also that with the online homeschooling charter sort of triple threat, that it's just a situation that's kind of ripe for profiteering, because what happens is that there's no teacher because you're homeschooling. So the parent becomes, you know, the quote-unquote teaching coach. And then what companies like K12.com and others like them do is provide, you know, maybe a laptop or, you know, some sort of computer setup. They provide some curriculum that's delivered, you know, either, you know, software or online. And the teaching, so to speak, happens online. So they really kind of successfully, so to speak, eliminate all the labor costs. And, you know, the quality of the curriculum that they're providing is very questionable, and also probably unbelievably cheap. And, you know, and so therefore, if you've got per pupil funding, which, as you mentioned, could be in the thousands of dollars, yet you're only providing like maybe $1,500 worth of actual stuff to students enrolled in this kind of instruction, then, you know, you can sort of see the potential for a lot of state money, taxpayer money, you know, funneling, as you say, directly into the pockets of these online learning companies. And I just wanted to mention too that, you know, it was very striking to me when you went around and did research and also talked to some of these lobbyists. That in plotting and planning all of this stuff, that they're quite open that, you know, fear and anger are kind of the buttons to push. And they've been doing that very successfully, I think. You know, parents are overwhelmingly concerned with their children's education, and I think far too many parents really kind of buy, you know, have drunk the Kool-Aid that public schools are a disaster, they're failing, they're in crisis, and it's not to minimize the ones that are, certainly, but, you know, you have to contrast that with a lot of people when they're surveyed about their local neighborhood school. There's, like, approval ratings of, like, 88%, you know, so there's a lot of cognitive dissonance there in terms of what it is that people believe about public education. And I think that, you know, the fear and the anger is really just about, you know, schools failing, schools in crisis, bad teachers, and, you know, those seem to have been, unfortunately, far too successful, especially in, you know, big city areas where it's very uneven in terms of the kinds of schools that children attend. So
it's very interesting how we got these outcomes. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, we just have a caller who's on the line here. It's Kathleen from Florida. Question.
Could we maybe let Lee finish his point and then Kathleen can jump right in? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll be quick. You know, there's a huge disconnect because I have to give a big shout out to Mother Jones, Stephanie Mercimer's article, and John Hechinger in Bloomberg Business Week had really interesting articles about how these virtual schools are actually delivered, the content. I mean, in a lot of cases, as you mentioned, the parents are just deputized. I mean, there's some kindergarten and first grade curriculums where basically they say, okay, student, log in, print out all of these coloring books and questionnaires, fill them out, and then go bring them to your parents and have them check on it and make sure the lines are colored in okay, or write this essay. And some of them aren't even graded online. There's the assumption that the parents will come in and do a lot of the work. So it's that's the bill of goods that is not being sold to the public when they're making these big choices to adopt these laws and to send possibly hundreds of millions to these companies. Instead, like you said, they're using nasty attack advertisements, smear campaigns against public schools, and as Rick Berman has done. I mean, he even has. This lobbyist that I quote in my piece, he even has ads that, in my view, he compares public teachers to child molesters. He was running them in New Jersey. I mean, it's really nasty stuff, but that's how they're getting this stuff fast.
So do we want to go to Kathleen? Are you there, Kathleen?
Yes, I am here. First of all, Lee, I just want to compliment you on your work. It was very thorough. I've been acting as an advocate as part of an organization, a statewide organization in Florida for 3 years now, and it was nice to see so many of these things put together. We're painfully aware of a lot of what's going on. But I wanted to make a point. You were talking about things to be on the lookout and with this virtual piece, and you know, Florida legislators, you have to ask who's profiting. It's all about money in Florida. And they have passed a law recently, this past session, that basically requires every child in Florida to take at least one online course in the course of their, you know, before they can graduate. And so there's 2.74 million children in Florida in public schools. So, you know, you just have to do a little bit of math and come up with some figure, $1,000 or so per course, and you know it's probably billions when it's all said and done, the money that they're chasing. So, you know, I think that we have to always understand that it has a lot to do with money. I mean, this is sadly, there's ideology that's being used to get at this money, but its bottom line does come with the money.
Well, you know, Kathleen, it's interesting. This law that you're speaking of, it wasn't just in Florida. It was also passed in Idaho. In Idaho, it's actually two online courses to graduate, and they wanted initially four. So it's a part of a larger campaign. Jeb Bush said it was one of his top priorities after the last election. And you're absolutely right. You have to look at who benefits, because, you know, I was at one of these lobbyist and legislator conventions 2 months ago in San Francisco, and the lobbyists made it clear that this is one of their top gets, because it's not just the curriculum companies. You know, everyone from Rosetta Stone to some of the older name companies to some of the tablet computer and laptop companies, they all see a potential to benefit from this. So you have to follow the money.
Well, I was just going to say, I sat on a panel with Jeb Bush about a couple months ago, and I sat right next to him, and it was very interesting. He made a lot of, you know, a lot out of measuring teachers, making them accountable, and the whole thing, you know, really getting to the root of all these bad teachers. Yet, on the other side of the coin, he's quick to deputize, as you were saying, parents as learning coaches and just, you know, have the parents, like you said, print out reams of coloring books and other things for kids and not even have a teacher teaching these children. Just having, you know, what other people don't realize, too, is some of these online courses are cartoons. They're not even human beings. They're like jumpstart learning type things.
Yeah,
and
they're avatars.
Mm-hmm.
Kathleen, I just wanted to mention what's going on in California. And actually, you in Florida, you and I know each other, you know, from other circles, from sort of parent activist and engagement circles, you know, working against this kind of thing. So I'm glad you were able to join us today. But actually, Kathleen in Florida was the one to alert me that in the state of California, where there are 6.3 million kids in the K-12 system, that they are trying to pass an online sort of bill of rights, online learning bill of rights, and there's, you know, been talk so far of, you know, getting it, making it a ballot initiative, getting signatures, so on and so forth. And basically, I thought it was very interesting, Lee, because in your piece you mentioned briefly, you know, that there may be some very sort of carefully circumscribed, you know, ways in which online delivery of education in some form might be useful, and you sort of mentioned, you know, rural schools, and that's what's interesting to me is that that's exactly the tack they're taking here in California. They're saying that, well, rural schools lack certain, you know, A through G requirements. They don't offer those classes. They may not offer AP classes because, you know, the teaching staffs are smaller. There may not be that kind of expertise and or specialization in the teaching staff. So therefore, you know, online education would be a boon for these people. And they're trying to say, well, we would, of course, you know, define it very carefully. There's a bit of back and forth about, you know, what is the value of a wet lab in science, online education, mm-hmm. you know, that kind of thing. So, you know, I'm even a little leery of that because I think the promise of profit from 6.3 million children is just too tempting to for many of these people to pass up. And we know that, you know, it's not just Florida. It's, as you mentioned, all these other states. I think you mentioned something like 20 plus some states that have either a online learning bill that has passed or is in some form sort of moving through the legislature. Is that
right?
Well,
just in the last, I think, 15 months, essentially 13 have passed the law, but there are another 26 that have been pending. For example, Pennsylvania is very likely to pass their law. You know, they've already have a kind of limited virtual school and voucher law. They want to vastly expand it, and that's very likely to pass. Governor Corbett would like to see it pass. Most of the legislature, it's just, you know, pushing those final few folks that are on the fence. And many other states, even some blue states, are adopting it. And I haven't seen that California proposal, but that's very interesting. I think, of course, the devil is always in the details. You can't trust the top-line message. But, you know, after this call, I'll look into it.
Yeah, I'll send you the link, definitely. California, of course, is also the sort of home to Michelle Rhee and Students First. I think she's now based in Sacramento, so, you know, we can't discount that also. She just hasn't gotten around to her home state yet to really, you know, sort of break open the market, so to speak. But I'm sure it's on her very busy agenda to get to very soon. Speaking of Students First, I also did want to kind of touch a little bit on the issue of parents and astroturfing, because I think that's part of the equation is, you know, what is it that, what kind of arguments will stakeholders buy, right? Are principals okay with this? Are teachers okay with this? Are parents okay with this? You know, what is the education research on any type of online learning, in whether it's blended learning, which is a combination of teacher and, you know, some sort of computer-assisted or technology-assisted kind of learning, to, you know, flat-out sort of charter homeschool, you know, online K-12.com type stuff. So maybe we can just go quickly and acknowledge our sponsor and then circle back around to that. We do have the capacity to go over a little bit. So, Kathleen, if you're also still with us, if you have additional comments or questions, you know, we can go over a little bit. And if Lee, if you're willing to hang out with us a little bit, but we should probably go ahead and acknowledge Bubble Genius. Donna, did you want to move us into that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because, you know, one of the things that all of us have been trying to do a lot more of is to omit the large chains as much as possible and go with small businesses and support local businesses. And, I mean, for those of us here in L.A., Bubble Genius is located in Burbank, California. They are vegan, natural, wonderful folks, and they are kind enough to be sponsoring us as well as other progressive voices on the internet. And the thing is that they've got beautiful, beautiful items for Christmas. I'm looking at their Tis the Season Christmas gift pack right now, and that comes in both a traditional and an irreverent option. The traditional option has Very Merry Christmas Mistletoe Soap on a Rope, Can't Catch Me Gingerbread Dude Soap, Oh Little Soap of Bethlehem Soap Set, and a Fruitcake Perfume Oil. And then if you want to go with the irreverent one, you can get a Glow With God Baby Jesus Soap on a Rope and a Naughty Sack of Coal Soap, as well as some other items. But they also make Hanukkah items. I know that several of my friends, hint, hint, are going to get Bubble Genius this year from me because the products smell so good and work so well, and we just love them.
It also works in the other direction in that we know what to get you, Donna, because we know you like the Bubble Genius stuff.
This is true. I have to start focusing on the ones that I really have an eye on. You know, they've got some wonderful gift packs here, so it's a lot of fun. BubbleGenius.com, and tell them that you heard about them through Momocrats.
So given that Momocrats has mostly female, although a lot of feminist men tune in too, so yay for them, and also participate, so yay for Lee. But I kind of wanted to pivot a little bit and talk about the stakeholder issue that I was kind of mentioning before our little Bubble Genius interlude. And Kathleen, I know that you have been organizing parents and sort of working to get the word out in Florida for a really long time now, like 4 years you've been doing this kind of organizing. Do you want to talk a little bit about that before we kind of circle back to Michelle Rhee?
Yes, certainly. Yes, it's very important to get parents and teachers involved in taking ownership in what happens to public education. I think that so much of the damage that's been done to teachers, in particular the teaching profession, is that, you know, their very professionalism has been attacked, and we're left with Jeb Bush, you know, saying that it just doesn't matter who teaches your child. Why, it could be somebody, the best teacher might be in Oregon, so we'll just all dial into that teacher and forget all the interactions that a child has in the classroom, you know, with a teacher. And you know, we find that people are very confused by the story of choice. They think it sounds easy and simple to do virtual school. They don't understand that it is a tremendous commitment, and it also has had some very mixed results, as recent articles have shown. You know, we are battling, you know, an issue that I don't know if you've talked about it yet, but this whole virtual charter, which the charter company gets the entire student funding piece, but does not, you know, have to have bricks and mortar. And so, you know, we just see that all of these privatizers look at the money that the taxpayers of this state and other states have shed blood, sweat, and tears over to provide, you know, a public education system. We see them just eyeing it greedily, like it's a pot of gold that they just have to get their hands on. We spend a lot of time educating parents and turning them into storytellers and people who will go out and tell this story to other people, because we do believe this movement is one of those things that will succeed from the roots up. It has been overrun with grasstop corporatized, you know, propaganda type information, and it is incumbent on the parents. It's, you know, what you're doing, Lee, what you're doing is so phenomenal, because anytime we can shed light from a national stage and combine that with growing up from the roots to create a message and energize the voices that we know are there, they're not happy with what they're seeing. They don't like being told it's $4 billion in cuts this year and $2 billion this year, next year. You know, we just went through getting $4 billion cut in Florida last year, and now they're going to cut another $2 billion again this year from public ed. So, you know, they're choking an essential public service, which is public education, and they're shoving this down everyone's throat that, you know, this privatized vision is better, and we've got to get the message to the voters and to the people who can make a difference before, you know, many of these reforms actually end up selling off our asset, which is public education.
Lee, I wanted to ask you more about the October 15th or mid-October event in San Francisco, where the Jeb Bush-sponsored, you know, group sort of got all these, you know, venture capitalists and ed tech, you know, edupreneurs, I think they sometimes call themselves too, together, because that's where you pointed out that there was a session called "Don't Let a Financial Crisis Go to Waste," mm-hmm. and how you know, a lot of these folks are now moving into not only campaign donations to Congress people, you know, at that level, but looking at state legislators and giving a lot of money there, but also going further and looking at school board representatives and getting involved in those kinds of elections too. And my question there is, like, this information is all so fabulous and well documented, and I'm wondering, to what extent, because you talk a little bit about how it's kind of difficult for you to have access to some of these things once they realize who you were and what you're all about. But it seems to me like if we were able to get, you know, more video clips, for example, of these people sort of, you know, doing their backroom dealing, that would be something very galvanizing. Because I know that parents, it's a lot for folks to kind of take in a lot of information. You know, your day as a parent is often chopped up. You have all these kinds of obligations. You have your kids. They need to be brought up somehow, so on and so forth. So, you know, time is often short, and sometimes a brief video clip can really drive the point home. What would be the likelihood of you perhaps, you know, or someone else pursuing, you know, that kind of thing and getting some kind of information like that that could go more viral?
You know, I think you're right. We live in a culture where I think social movements, political movements are galvanized by online videos. It's kind of an interesting phenomenon. We've seen that from the Tea Party to the Occupy Wall Street movement, where these kind of videos that crystallize lots of issues at once whether it's someone yelling at a congressman or seeing police brutality, it brings people out and puts them into the street because it makes them upset, and it shows them what's going on at a more emotional level, in a factual way, though. That being said, you know, maybe we should talk a little bit offline about this, but, you know, some of these videos, some of these things that I've gathered, it took me almost 6 months to research this piece. For one reason, I still had to kind of familiarize myself with the K-12 education landscape. But the other thing is, there's just so much out there. Some of the videos that were particularly jarring to me were some of the videos I was able to find of an investor conference actually back in April of this year, hosted by a former Lehman Brothers banker named Michael Moe, who's kind of a de facto leader of the kind of small army of Wall Street venture capitalists who are trying to get into this space. And he basically explains on video that he wants to do to K-12 education what his buddies did in the 90s to healthcare. Mm-hmm. He said back then in the 90s, healthcare was the one big undercapitalized sector of the American economy. You had this huge chunk of billions and billions of dollars that the for-profit sector could not take advantage of because so many hospitals were organized as nonprofits back then. Many of the insurance companies, even the Blue Cross Blue Shields, many of them were nonprofits back then. And of course, as you know, all of that changed in the mid-90s. He explicitly showed with his own kind of graphs and charts and examples that K-12 education is the next frontier. It's the final big sector of the economy that's undercapitalized, that, mm-hmm. that hasn't been taken advantage of. But I think it would be very difficult to find those actual backroom deals. You get kind of these investor presentations. I can probably help you show you videos of strategy sessions like the ones I discussed in the piece and similar ones on how to crack and take over school boards or how to lobby and implement some of these ideas in the legislature. But the kind of smoky backroom dealing, I think they don't allow a video camera even close to those types of things. I tried to get into one kind of secret meeting in San Francisco before the big conference that Jeb Bush and Rupert Murdoch was at. And, you know, they didn't let me in. I saw Mayor Senti there. We kind of chatted a little while. But, you know, that's the nature of these things. The kind of big strategy sessions, the backroom deals where they're actually plotting where to place the money and who benefits, that's kept far from the public view. You can just see it in the policy outcomes and the campaign contribution reports that come out months later.
Well, we'll have to find some crafty way. How, I don't know, but
I think it can be done.
Yes, I will. Maybe we will have to have a strategy session at some point. But I also want to highlight that part of what you said earlier that is so effective about these billionaire philanthropists and or you know, venture capitalists who are salivating at the education market, so to speak, and wanting to privatize, is that they're very effective in creating, you know, spinning off all these little 501c3s. And I think that circling back to Students First, you know, we're seeing a lot of these kinds of quote-unquote grassroots groups rise up, and with seemingly somewhat bland, but, you know, who could disapprove of standing up for Students First, right? Or, you know, wanting good schools for everyone, or, you know, the best teachers, you know, teaching in every school, you know, kind of vague generalities. And as you point out, you know, the devil's always in the details. But, you know, maybe that's another avenue for research and unveiling is, you know, kind of looking at the roots more closely of these kinds of organizations and where they get their funding, and kind of aligning that with the sort of more corporate agenda that's being pushed by both conservatives and these kinds of neoliberal education entrepreneurs.
It would be very scary to see how Students First uses its money next year in the election.
Yeah.
The DeVos group that they're, I think, kind of basing their strategy off of, Alliance for Children, and they've got several names for their different political action committees. But they were very quiet about this. They sent out a lot of attack mailers, a couple of TV advertisements, I think some robocalls. But, you know, you don't need to put a lot of money in these state legislative campaigns, and you can make a big difference on the state level. I mean, you just throw $10,000 or $20,000 at a state delegate race, and you can win, or state assembly, that sort of thing. It's not mm-hmm. like running for Congress. And Students First, I mean, I'm sure you've seen, they promised to raise $1 billion to spend in lobbying and attack ads. I doubt they'll make that much money, but they've already got pledges of, I think, almost $100 million. So, you know, that's a devastating amount.
If I could just, I think we should probably wrap up because we didn't actually promise Lee much beyond 10:15. So, Kathleen, if you had just like a really quick thing, and then maybe I'll just throw in a last comment.
No, I just was going to say we've seen evidence of the races being purchased here, and the All Children Matter, or Every Children, All Children Matter, Betsy DeVos has really made an impact in being exactly what you're saying, Lee, here in Florida. So.
Well, I'll definitely have to connect you to Lee later, Kathleen. So I guess my last comment is really more that, you know, in California at least, it seems like an uphill battle because, of course, Silicon Valley is the site and source of a lot of this kind of tech-leaning education, philanthropy funding. Of course, Bill Gates is based in Seattle, but certainly, you know, there's a lot of ferment and excitement about, you know, bringing the gifts, quote-unquote, of technology to education, and if that means privatizing education, well, you know, public schools are just crap anyway, right? So that's kind of the attitude that very often that we're facing. So I think it's tricky because right now, you know, California, we're also looking at severe defunding. We're about to have some trigger cuts come into play on the K-12 level at the UC and Cal State level. We have students, you know, uprisings all around, you know, the state's campuses because, you know, tuition has been raised twice and three times within, say, 12 to 18-month periods. And, you know, it's very difficult for families to plan for that kind of expense, especially when it keeps climbing out of reach. So, you know, I think we are looking at a sort of a tricky situation, at least in California, simply because the successful Silicon Valley industries that could conceivably be the source of a lot of revenue that could go toward public education is instead or at the very same time the source of a lot of this kind of push to privatize public education through online learning and that kind of affiliated lobbying and you know sort of jockeying that goes on with it. So It's going to be very interesting coming up in the next several months, and then also when Jerry Brown has to pass a budget by June 30th. You know, it'll be really interesting to see what happens in this state. So I think we're going to have to wrap up really soon, but I think my final and ultimate point is that with pieces like Lee's, it's wonderful that you've also brought in, you know, the sort of multi-state comparison of what's going on, because I think as parents and as people who care about public education, we get sort of siloed in, you know, what's happening in our local school or what's happening just in our state, and so it's good to keep an eye on what's going on all around the country because, you know, what is being tested in one place can very easily end up, you know, being, you know, coming to your legislature next. So that's something to be really aware of. Lee, did you have any final comments?
Well, you know, I just one last comment. It's just I'm obsessed with following the money, and I just urge and implore everyone who's interested in this topic to do the same. You know, even for a big company like K-12 Inc. that has all of these problems, you know, I think there's this one study that shows that only 25% of their students are able to pass the minimum standards outlined by No Child Left Behind, and there's all of these kind of horror stories and these scandals. You know, they outsourced some of their testing and their Arizona virtual school to India. You know, you can talk about all these things, but just follow the money because, you know, you'll see K-12 Inc. set up a virtual school in Wisconsin or Florida, but you have to look at who benefits. And you talk about Silicon Valley, it's not just the big virtual school technology companies are based there. The big investors in these types of companies are based there. Larry Ellison, the CEO of Oracle, you know, he's out in Silicon Valley. He invested $10 million in K-12 Inc., and that was in the very beginning of the company, so it's worth a lot more now.
Right.
So you just have to kind of follow this web. It gets complicated, but I think it provides a lot of answers. So I want to thank Cynthia and everyone I talked to today, Donna, Kathleen, Caroline. It was really nice being invited on your show today.
Yeah, thank you so much, and we hope to see more from you, you know, on this and other topics. Follow the money, as you say, is always the key, I think. So thank you so much. Thank you, everybody, for joining in today and calling in and asking questions and, you know, great questions and comments all around. And one last caveat, K-12 News Network is not in any way affiliated or connected to K-12.com, which is why feel free to take a whack at them as much as I want to. So thanks again, and goodbye, everybody. Thanks for joining.
Bye. Thank you, Lee.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.